From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been almost 1 year since the first known person in the U.S. to die of COVID-19. And as the virus that causes COVID-19 has spread around the world in the last 12 months, it's also mutated. One writer for Vox described it this way. The virus is mutating like typos on a computer. The more words you type, the more opportunities there are for errors. The virus is the same. The more it spreads, the more opportunities it has to evolve. And researchers are concerned about the ways the virus is changing. Some of the mutations discovered in recent months are causing the virus to spread more easily and potentially make it more deadly. We're joined now by two experts to tell us what we know about these new variants and what we still have to learn. Sarah Kobe is an associate professor of microbiology and evolution at the University of Chicago. Sarah, welcome to The 21st.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd also like to welcome back Chris Brook. He's an assistant professor of microbiology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chris, thanks for joining us again.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you have questions for our guests about these new coronavirus variants and what the implications are for us here in Illinois, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you've ever just wanted to ask a microbiologist a question about COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 or anything else related to this, this is your opportunity, 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Sarah, I want to begin with you. So what are the different variants of the coronavirus?
Well, as you mentioned, the coronavirus has been mutating an awful lot in the last year. And some of those groups of mutations, which we call clades, we've been naming as these variants. And there are a couple that have obviously really caught our eye. There's the B117 variant, catchy name, that's been emerging in the UK. And we can tell that it's more transmissible and causes more severe infections. But there are also other notable variants, particularly one that's been emerging in South Africa, B1351 and P1 from Brazil, which also appear to be associated with big outbreaks and potentially some escape from the major antibody response that we mount to SARS-CoV-2.
You know, you mentioned there's a concern. Are these more infectious? I've also seen questions about, are they more deadly? And my question is, does it matter if it's more deadly, if it is more infectious? Because if more people are infected, more people are likely to die. Can you talk about the, what is different about these particular strains we're discussing?
So you just touched on some really essential math there, which is, what's actually really worrying is when we see a variant that's much more transmissible, because SARS-CoV-2 is, pretty deadly anyway. And so if there's a variant that transmits much better, then we know that more people are going to die from it. So we have the best data so far on the transmissibility of this variant that emerged in the UK, B117. And I think the data are pretty strong there. We've also seen it in Switzerland, Denmark, that variant spreads really fast. So it is more transmissible, which we can think of as more infectious. And it is also associated with more severe infections. So unfortunately, it's got both. It's a double whammy. The other variants certainly look like they're very transmissible, and some of that transmissibility might arise from the fact that we can tell in laboratory experiments that our antibodies are less reactive to them or neutralize them less well. But we're really still waiting for key pieces of evidence to come together that allow us to assign some sort of change in transmission rate or infectiousness or disease severity to them. So the jury's still kind of out on them.
Chris, are these variants in Illinois now? How concerned should we be about them spreading here?
So we know that the B117 variant has been, found within the state of Illinois. For the P1 and the B1351 variants that Sarah mentioned, we don't really have a very clear picture. I mean, we don't really have a clear picture on the extent of spread of any of these variants in the United States. Because we're not really doing a lot of the viral genomic sequencing that's needed to actually confirm when someone is infected with one of these variants versus sort of garden variety SARS-CoV-2. It's a black box right now.
Yeah, I mean, is that, obviously this is a, this pandemic has presented us with a lot of situations that I think we weren't prepared for. We're learning now after having lived with this for a year. Should there have been more sequencing, or was that overlooked, or was it just a question of capacity? Why hasn't that happened as much?
Well, I think from the very beginning, there's been sort of this race where we've been a little bit behind the curve and sort of deploying the resources we need to combat this virus. So whether that's testing capacity, which is still to an extent limited a year on, or vaccinations, vaccine doses, and now genomic sequencing. So absolutely, it would be helpful from a public health standpoint to have a more clear and accurate picture of the extent of spread of these new variants of concern in the United States and in Illinois. But without that genomic sequencing at scale, it's, you know, we're operating a little bit in the dark.
And maybe just for those of us, definitely including myself, who are not virologists or microbiologists, when we're talking about genomic sequencing, I mean, it's one thing to do a sort of blunt COVID-19 test, even if you're doing the sort of gold standard PCR test, right? But then you're talking about sort of really digging into the genetic map, the DNA, and seeing how it might compare to the original sequence of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19?
That's exactly right. And to be clear, it's a lot more sort of technically demanding than the standard diagnostic tests that are being done across the country. So there's only certain places have the ability and equipment to do this. And it would absolutely take sort of a significant amount of resources and will to expand the capacity. But I think, you know, as Sarah mentioned, we know more about this B117 variant than the others, largely because it emerged in the UK, where they have been sort of world leaders and in doing viral genomic screening. And so they were able to identify this variant relatively early and track its spread with a pretty good degree of accuracy.
Sarah, can you talk about why these variants are appearing now? I mean, is it possible we've missed other variants and now we're just detecting them? Or is there something about the way the virus has been spreading? I mean, we're a year into this, and it seems like only in the last month or two that at least those of us who follow this on mass media, maybe it's been in the journals before that, but why now?
That's a really good question. And I think it's a very deep question that evolutionary biologists are going to be talking about for years to come. But here's how I'm thinking about it. So a lot of these variants, you know, when we look back, you know, Chris is talking about doing this like in-depth genomic surveillance. So you can reconstruct phylogenies or trees showing, from which other strains these variants descended. And we can see that a lot of these variants arose, you know, over 6 months ago. So it's not as though, you know, like they just kind of popped onto the scene. What we're seeing instead is kind of this, you know, playing out like in ecological terms. You know, these variants have been competing with each other, and we see that like certain ones are winning. And we're also, of course, there's more genomic surveillance, you know, than there has been. So we're able to observe all this variation a little bit better and closer to real time. So, you know, this is an RNA virus. It has a pretty high mutation rate. It's not as high as flus, but it's still really high. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, basic evolution that if the virus is going to be infecting more hosts, then there are just more opportunities, you know, for additional mutations. So we kind of expect to get this like a lot of branching. And I think a major question is, are we going to start seeing, you know, some of these variants really like winning out over others, and how much diversity are we going to expect in the long run? But it's not a very quantitative answer to your question, but in some ways I'd say this isn't too surprising. You know, a lot of the variation is happening in the major surface protein, the spike protein that we know it's not only the target of antibodies, but it's also just the protein that, you know, the virus uses to infect the host cell. And of course, it's still adapting to us. So, you know, we might look back and see that some of these variants are really, you know, critical, you know, components of that adaptation process. And some of them might be more associated with immune escape, but I think it's too early to say.
Interesting. Right. Yeah, no, I appreciate the sort of philosophical answer here. I mean, really, we're seeing the sort of Darwinian natural selection playing out in real time, right? The copies of the virus that are most transmissible are going to be the ones that come to dominate. I mean, that's what this would tell us, right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Okay. Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guests. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the evolution of the coronavirus and some of the new variants that are emerging and have been found here in Illinois, even. We're joined by Sarah Kobe, an associate professor of ecology and evolution at the University of Chicago. We're also speaking with Chris Brook, an assistant professor of microbiology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Chris, we just heard Sarah talking about the spike on the virus, and of course, those of us who have followed this know that's what the vaccines, at least the two ones that are out there now, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, are focusing on that spike. What do these variants mean for the vaccines that have been going into people's arms?
Right. So that's a great question. And so, you know, the spike protein that's on the surface of the virus particle, it plays this key role in sort of binding to this protein on our cells that allows it to get into and then infect those cells. And as this virus is evolving potentially to be better at infecting us, it's picking up some of these changes and these variants on that spike protein that may be making it better able to infect our cells. The issue is that our immune system also primarily targets the spike protein, and these vaccines are targeted against the spike protein. And many of the parts on the spike protein that our immune system is targeting are the same ones that might be changing as the virus is evolving to be better at infecting us. And so, as Sarah, you know, mentioned, a couple of these mutations that are showing up in these variants have already been shown in the laboratory to reduce the ability of some antibodies to bind and block these viruses. I think we still don't have a very good idea of what effect these variants are going to have on how well the sort of Moderna and Pfizer vaccines that have been widely or that are, you know, predominating in the U.S. are going to protect us against severe infection. So there's still a lot of open questions here.
Let me try out, you know, I'm always like to try out analogies here. If the spikes are keys into our cells, is the concern that the sort of the variants are sort of changing the shape of the keys, changing the ridges on the keys, and yet the vaccines we have are, you know, sort of formulated to the key as it was at the beginning?
Right. So that's a great analogy. So absolutely, you can think of, you know, what's happening in these variants is that the keys are changing a little bit to better fit the locks. And it just, you know, our immune system also targets those same areas. And so, you know, the vaccines are directed against the sort of parental or garden variety SARS-CoV-2. And so the antibodies that they elicit, some of them may not recognize these new viruses as well as the original virus. Now, to be clear, though, these vaccines work really, really, really well. And so a significant reduction in how well how well some of these antibodies bind the virus may not have a huge effect on how protective the vaccines are. And how well they protect us against severe infection outcomes and potentially limit transmission.
Right. If we have 95% protection against severe infection, if it drops down to 85 when, you know, a year ago we were hoping for 50, right, that we're still doing okay or better than we might otherwise do.
Exactly right. And there's still, you know, again, laboratory tests are very highly reductionist and show that certain classes of antibodies don't bind these viruses as well. But these vaccines, as well as natural infection, elicit multiple arms and a highly varied array of cells and molecules from your immune system against the virus. And so even a reduction in the potency of a subset of those may not have a huge effect on the protective efficacy of the vaccine. And so we still just don't know yet. It's okay. Obviously, there's cause for concern, but not panic.
Yeah. Okay. We need to take a break in about a minute, but Sarah, before we do, just briefly, does the pacing of the vaccine rollout affect how much the virus, we can expect it to continue to evolve? If pace ramps up, will that sort of help us in the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. The more we vaccinate, you know, the fewer possible people, you know, the virus has to infect. And that means really like not just there'll be fewer mutations, but we actually expect there to be a reduced rate of adaptation. But when we're talking about that, I think it's probably important to take a global perspective. And vaccination rollout is still very, very slow to non-existent in much of the world.
No, that's a great point. I mean, as slow as we think it is here in Illinois and in the United States, there are places that it's even much slower, and the virus is going to continue to do what it does there. All right. We, as I said, we need to take a break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking about the variants of the coronavirus that have been emerging, as we've heard throughout this pandemic, but that are just gaining a lot more attention and seem to be spreading now, even in Illinois. We are speaking with Sarah Coby, who is Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago. Also, Chris Brook, an Assistant Professor of Microbiology at U of I Urbana-Champaign. You can join our conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about COVID-19 and specifically the virus that causes COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, and the way it's been evolving, the new variants of the coronavirus. We're speaking with Sarah Coby, Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, and Chris Brook, Assistant Professor of Microbiology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you have a question, this is your opportunity to ask a microbiologist, 800-222-9455. Once again, the number is 800-222-9455. Chris, I wonder, do these variants mean, and maybe not just these variants, maybe this is the case anyway, but are we going to have to learn to live with this virus for potentially many, many years to come, sort of like the AIDS virus? Is this something that people are going to have to be regularly vaccinated against, like measles? Where are you on this question right now?
Yeah, I mean, those are great questions. And obviously, we're going to have to see. I think probably, one expectation is that this we'll see something very similar to what you see with pandemic influenza viruses, or likely with where you have basically this virus emerge into people from animals, cause a pandemic, and then sort of establish itself within the human population where it circulates for years after, causing much less severe disease because people already have some degree of protective immunity. We already have a handful of sort of seasonal human coronaviruses that are circulating that are associated with common cold-like symptoms. And so I think one very possible outcome for this is that it may establish itself in the human population more like a seasonal flu or a seasonal coronavirus. And depending on the severity of infection in people who have been previously infected or vaccinated, we'll probably, we might have to update the vaccines. And I think, with these variants, Moderna and Pfizer and others are already moving to update the vaccine to accommodate these new variants.
And that's one of the great things about this, without getting into detail, people can go back and listen to our past conversations on it, but the mRNA vaccine is that it's fairly easy to sort of tweak the genetic code, I guess, in there to make it adapt to the variants.
Exactly right. I mean, that's one of the most exciting things about this platform is that you can change it and update it so quickly as opposed to the sort of more old-fashioned technologies that we're more used to and that we see with the seasonal influenza vaccine, where it takes nearly a year to update and manufacture because you're having to grow the virus up and treat it and do all these things that take a long time. So yeah, the sort of agility speed with which you can update these mRNA platforms is really exciting. I think you're going to see them used against a wider variety of pathogens in the future.
Interesting. Sarah, I've got a couple more questions on the vaccine, but before we do, I wonder if there's anything you want to add to what Chris was saying and my question there. I mean, it seems like elimination of this virus, the way we have with certain other diseases, is not something that's going to be in the cards for humankind.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that that's totally right. You know, if we had enough of the mRNA vaccines to give to a very large fraction of the global population over a short period of time, then maybe we could start talking. But no, I think this virus is too mutable and we're not hitting it hard and fast enough. But I also agree, you know, with what Chris said about the fact that the future of the disease is probably, it's a lot better than what we're experiencing now. And I think there's going to be a lot of kind of residual like immunity that protects us against future variants and reduces the severity of infections.
Interesting. Okay. So Sarah, let me ask you about people who have been getting the vaccine. There are a growing number of people. We're hearing some optimistic reports out of the government that they think the production is going to continue to ramp up and get more shots in arms in the coming months here. What precautions should people be taking after they get the vaccines? It seems the guidance is don't really change much in terms of masking and physical distancing and all the rest.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is an area where there's a lot of research, and so the situation might be different in a couple months. But for now, I mean, anybody getting a first dose should be especially careful in, you know, the first 2 weeks after that dose to assume that they are still totally susceptible to infection. And really, they should be, you know, probably, you know, assuming they're at risk for several weeks after that, really into, you know, the second dose, if they get that. And actually, that brings me to the other point, which is, you know, people who have had a confirmed infection now, there's potentially going to be some shift in policy. I'm not exactly on top of it. It's very active. But, you know, they should be waiting before they get vaccinated, because, you know, it looks like your immune system from a single infection is quite primed. And then getting, you know, two vaccines on top of that might, you know, involve more unpleasantness and, you know, than you need to be quite protected. So, you know, in the short run, you know, I'm very confident that the vaccines are going to be reducing infectiousness and transmissibility. And there's already a lot of evidence in that direction. But while, you know, the virus is spreading rapidly in the population, it makes sense for everyone to continue to be careful.
Interesting. You know, we had a caller who did not want to go on air, did not want to give their name or town, but did have a very specific question. Apparently, she got the Moderna first dose, wondering if she can get the second dose at 25 days instead of 28 days. I wonder if you have a perspective on that.
This is very contentious.
Okay.
This question of the acceptable durations between doses, because there's what the FDA approved, and then there's also how immunologists think about, you know, what their immune response to these vaccines is like. So, you know, I think right now it is permitted for there to be a little more flexibility between the doses. This is something that should be confirmed, I think, with doctors. But I believe that that there's been a little more wiggle room granted. Maybe Chris can jump in here. But as far as like the quality of the immune response, like I would not worry about it. It's probably going to be quite protective to get the second dose after 25 days.
If I read through the lines of what you're saying, it's like the FDA, because it's an emergency authorization, it has very specific protocols, 28 days, you know, you have to wait around 15 minutes after you get the shot. But what you're saying is the way you understand, you know, this to work as somebody who studies immune response is that it probably doesn't, you know, a couple of days here and there maybe doesn't matter as much.
Yeah, I'm saying that, again, not as a clinician, but as a scientist,
sure,
just thinking
sure.
about, you know, how we develop good immune responses. Yep.
Chris, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I would agree with Sarah. I mean, you know, these companies and the FDA had to test the safety and efficacy of these vaccines at an extraordinary, unprecedented rate. And to do that, you know, they had to set protocols in place for their trials. And so they picked these times, you know, 3 weeks for the Pfizer, 4 weeks for the Moderna, and they had to stick to that in the trial. And so all we really have are the results of those trials that say with this specific regimen, it's this safe and it works this well. But yeah, I think, so we try and stick to that, and you can't, you know, but as Sarah was saying, like as an immunologist, there's nothing magical about 28 days versus 25 days.
Okay, interesting. Chris, what about double masking? This is a new recommendation, relatively new recommendation. I have seen people doing it before the CDC made the recommendation. I mean, should we just start wearing 3-4 masks? I mean, where do we go with this? And what do you make of this? Is it related to the new variants, or is this just ongoing research into the best way to sort of prevent transmission?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think there are some diminishing returns with 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 masks. I think 2 is about as far as you want to go. But yeah, masks are all about mitigation and mitigating the probability that either virus, if you're infected, that the virus that you're exhaling is going to be able to get out to infect someone else. Or if you're in an environment with people that are shedding virus, that the virus is going to be able to access your respiratory tract. And so, you know, it's really, you know, so by that measure, 2 masks are obviously going to be more restrictive and a more powerful sort of mitigator of transmission than a single mask. And I think it's both a combination of increased concern, as it's become very clear that at a minimum, this B.1.1.7 variant is more contagious than the parental virus. And secondly, as we've learned more about how this virus spreads and the role of aerosols and the role of airflow and things like that. And so, I think it's absolutely a good idea. And
Okay. Well, we probably need to wrap up this conversation here in a minute or two. But Sarah, final question to you, and this is sort of a self-interested question as a member of the media. I don't know if you consume a lot of general interest news on COVID-19, but to the extent you do, I've been wondering, you know, a year ago, early in the pandemic, the media, including myself, driven in part by what we were hearing from public health authorities, were downplaying the dangers, potential dangers of this virus. I remember quoting the state's public health director, telling people, go about your lives, you know, urging them not to buy up masks because they wanted to reserve them for healthcare providers. And I think a lot of people in the media are feeling burned by, in retrospect, was, you know, a falsely and dangerously optimistic presentation. And so a lot of us are now being more pessimistic. And I wonder, do you think the media is overreporting what we don't know about vaccines and to some extent these new variants, and maybe underreporting how good and effective the vaccines are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, I completely agree that the media did get burned early in the pandemic. Definitely everyone I knew in my field was extremely worried about the pandemic that was coming. And now, yes, one thing I do wish would shift in the reporting is that, you know, again, there is a lot we know about how immune responses work and about how, you know, like correlates of protection and, you know, correlates of infectiousness and transmission that we can draw from like our research on and influenza, for instance, and other pathogens. And sometimes I'm afraid, as Chris was saying, that we're sometimes like a little too narrowly focused on, you know, the precise data that we have from clinical trials and not thinking so much about the bigger picture here, which is that there have been, you know, thousands of scientists studying the pathology, epidemiology, evolution, you know, immunology of pathogens like SARS-CoV-2 for a very long time. So we know in some ways a lot more, you know, than what is reported in like these single studies.
Okay. And I think we'll probably leave the conversation there. I want to thank Sarah Coby, Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, and Chris Brook, Assistant Professor of Microbiology at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Sarah, Chris, thanks so much for being with me and sharing your expertise with us today on the 21st.